or on page 172. Fasting, the ultimate point here is that, as Jimmy mentioned a week or so ago, I guess not here on a Wednesday night, but otherwise, that basically one point of this is we don't fast, basically. What we do is not really fasting. It's not ascetic fasting. The only reason that it even seems like a physical effort is because we live in a society that is so absolutely devoted to fulfilling the least desire or twinge. We sit around and we say things like, which Elder Paisio, St. Paisio says someplace, you should not be asking yourself, what shall we eat now? And we do that all the time. Sharon and I do. Because we want to find something that, I mean, basically we're not hungry, but it's been 4 hours since our last time we ate, and we're bored, you know, with the food, that we want to have something that's really good and tempting and enticing that you can enjoy in a way that the monks would never enjoy anything in a way, you know, so we want to think of something that's really tempting, that is palatable, even though we may not have experienced hunger in 20 years, actual hunger. We don't even know what hunger is anymore, and if you're like me, you know, you just overeat every time, or sometimes you even, I think I'll wait until I'm really hungry because I won't be able to enjoy stuffing myself to the degree that I will be able to if I wait a little while. Monastic fasting is so far beyond us, that's the point that's made here. And yet on the other hand, there is an importance of fasting to us as laymen in the desert. And those are the kind of the two major points in this section. On page 172, this section starts out with the last paragraph on the page. There is one more signpost on the road to purity of heart, and that signpost is fasting. Fasting is a spiritual tool, never an end in itself. Abba Theonis lists it among those things that do some spiritual good, but can also be left out. Now, he's talking about how they can be left out as an ascetical discipline. Since we don't engage in fasting as an actual ascetic discipline, he's not really talking to us at this point. He'll talk to us a little bit later on. But what I think Opperwall and Abba Theonis is pointing out to us here is that we ought not to set fasting up as though it is a holy thing that we do, and in a kind of a legalistic way, or in a way where we rely on our will and effort, I'm going to, you know, the worst example of non-fasting is, comes from a tradition that is not our tradition, from outside of Orthodoxy, the idea of giving something up for Lent. If that's the way we're thinking about fasting, then don't even bother, because it's not fasting. I'm going to give something up for Lent. God is not concerned about our discontinuing a bad habit for 40 days or not indulging ourselves to the degree that we usually do for 40 days or on Wednesdays and Fridays. Fasting can be two things. In the monastic context, it's a serious ascetic effort that can help, that can do some spiritual good, but it can't be set up as an end in itself. And for those of us who are not monks, we will be instructed in a different way of approaching it in a few pages. So fasting, in top of 173, fasting and other bodily practices are necessary because of the material nature of many sins. So sins of the flesh. And the sin of the flesh here is gluttony, or you could be a gourmand, a connoisseur who only wants the best. This also is something that is not spiritually good. I disdain ordinary fried chicken. I must have Kentucky Fried Chicken as it is meant to be, as it was supposed to have been in the beginning when Colonel Sanders was making it himself, pressure cooking chicken in a pressure cooker so that it gets the maximum amount of grease and oil into that chicken and the batter that goes into it, so that when you pull it out, it's like the chicken version of espresso, only with grease instead of caffeine. Squeeze as much grease into it as you possibly can in this special way, and that's Kentucky Fried Chicken with the secret spices and all the rest of that. So only that will satisfy me. This run-of-the-mill fried chicken.
Only mellow mushroom.
Only mellow mushroom pizzas. Nothing else will do. This Domino, inferior Domino product that uses anise. Do you use anise in your? Do you?
In our sauce.
Mm-hmm. That's good.
Doesn't stand.
We haven't privy to this recipe, but.
Oh, it's a secret recipe.
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Like Kentucky Fried Chicken.
Yes.
Well, this is always at the peak. It's always that's the way it is.
Secret recipe. Yeah.
Domino's, they'll tell anybody probably, and there's too. I know there's too much anise in their pizza. That's for sure. Because you don't know who wants a licorice flavored pizza, not me.
Yeah, we're not even that much.
I wouldn't mind trying that.
Well, Domino's might be able to do it for you. So you could be a gourmand. So you could be a glutton or a gourmand. A gourmand is a connoisseur of mm-hmm. only the best. This also one should fast from. You know, this is also self-indulgence.
Glutton's go to Quincy's.
Yes, glutton's go to. I haven't taken the Quincy's pledge, but I haven't been there many years now. But that's true. There's always an all-you-can-eat place.
Yes.
Europeans come here; they cannot believe there are places like this. Mm-hmm. All-you-can-eat. You know, this is an American thing. For the fathers, gluttony, which drives us to the desire of food, is the most essential example of this kind of sin, and is in fact a prototype of all sin, because it was by a wrong act of eating that Adam fell. You know, eating the apple. Both body and soul need to be involved in overcoming these sins of the flesh. In fact, the body provides the opportunity for the soul to overcome something and take spiritual advantage from it. That's what is meant at the bottom of 172 when it said that this is a spiritual tool. It's a spiritual tool that involves the body so that the body is helpful in a spiritual effort. You can make a parallel between this and the helpfulness of money, in that it's helpful that you don't become controlled by it. Father Marcus has told me last time I went to confession, you know, at the top of my confession was my gluttony, and I just, he saw that I felt that I was really serious, and I was really just kind of, you know, almost in despair of the spiritual life. And I mentioned to him, you know, all of the spiritual texts say, this is where you start. If you don't get beyond gluttony, what hope is there for you? Because it's the most basic thing you're supposed to deal with. Well, I have also read the things that he pointed out to me. He encouraged me and he said, you know, there are monks of girth on Holy Mountain, and among them are holy men. It's not a barrier that you must do this or there is no other possibility. And on the one hand, it's better that you should realize that you are totally in the grip of this and gain humility from that, than that you exercise a stupendous, heroic effort, overcome it, which I have done, and get down to the weight that you should be, and then fall prey to pride. So you are humbled by your being in the control of this sin, and there are sins that control us. And if we can repent of them, and yet at the same time not use our will and our ego to successfully overcome them, we're in a good place as far as humility is concerned. Not to let yourself off the hook. You don't just give up and just say, okay, that's it. I'm a glutton. I accept it. I'm humble, and I'm going to just go out and go to Quincy's and just humbly go back for the second and third time and just cry in my fried chicken about how sad I feel about myself. No, this is also self-indulgence. So you don't get to do that. But the point is to use the body to gain humility. Now, if we gain humility by being humble about the fact that we are in the grip of this passion, that's something. It's better than pride, at least. So that's encouraging too. No one else here is as large as I am, so that's I guess information for myself. But
I have a higher metabolism.
Well, you know, that goes away. You know, that
starting to
yeah, that goes away eventually. You know, I can assure you. You should have seen me when I was 17. Energy to burn, but those days are gone. By way of fasting then, the Christian makes his or her response to sin equally as material as their sins themselves, if it's a sin of the flesh we're talking about battling like with like. So it is critical that fasting be tempered with balance. Now we're talking again here about ascetic fasting. You know, there's a place in the Ladder of Divine Ascent where St. John of the Ladder points out several examples of monastics that are just totally over the edge as far as their efforts. And they are being so ridiculously ascetic that they're engaged in something that is not spiritually positive at all. So balance is critical here. Much of the discussion in the conferences about fasting with balance centers on the problem of monks who fast too much or too sternly, as though you could accomplish spiritual movement toward Christ or purity of heart by self-control. You end up building more of an ego. By doing so, such monks are puffed up with pride or fail to carry out the basic duties of hospitality when visited by a brother or pilgrim. Okay, so we're advised to fast with balance if we are involved in genuine ascetic fasting, which again, this is information for us so we understand the nature of fasting. You know, but not something that we actually seriously participate in. But this fasting with balance is the general norm for abstinence. According to each person's capacity of strength, health, and age, everyone allows himself or herself as much as they need for the maintenance of the flesh. And there's a real parallel here, again, to wealth. As much as is necessary, and beyond that, then you've been given something special that you have the opportunity to deal with in a more spiritual way. It's the same thing here with the need of the body to maintain itself. Maintain the flesh, beyond that you don't need. Beyond that you're taking it for spiritual self-comfort rather than seeking Christ. So you're misusing beyond what you need in a spiritually self-destructive way. So maintenance of the flesh and not the desire to stuff himself where you feel content and not worried about it because it's okay. Now I can stop. Now I'm good to go. It's called pride of the flesh, where you have satisfaction and more than enough. Now that you have the peace of being satiated. For on either side, a person can suffer serious injury by eating way too little or way too much. And if you waffle between squeezing the stomach by maintaining an immoderate fast and then stretching it with too much food, this is not going to be good for your body. You're doing injury to your body. Your body is not serving as a means towards spiritual improvement. Balance in fasting means avoid any temptation to be so harsh as to damage the body, as well as any impulse to go lax and slide into vice. The vision of balance and fasting that the conferences describe as normal would probably strike virtually all modern lay people and probably even most modern monastics as almost impossibly harsh. Now, there is an example at the bottom of the page that is perfectly clear to me, but I am so distant from the possibility of the first example about two loaves of bread in a day of about a pound each. It seems excessive to me. Because, I mean, we have meat in abundance. We have five food groups or seven food groups or wherever they are. The idea of living on bread, my body has no experience of it. My mind can't wrap itself around this idea. But two loaves, I mean, a pound is a pretty good, it's a loaf of bread, you know. And two loaves of bread a day, but nothing else. I don't know what that's about. I have no direct experience of that.
Especially being a diabetic, that wouldn't.
That's true. You know, I would be unconscious, and who knows, maybe even go into shock. You know, to sit down and eat that much starch that would turn into sugar and wipe me out. But even if I weren't diabetic before, just the idea of eating two whole seems like a lot. Does it seem like a lot to anybody else?
Thinking about it, would yeah.
Huh?
I was trying to determine how much bread that was because
it's 2 pounds.
Yeah, but
in your like fluffy loaves of like bread, it might be a whole loaf of bread.
Right. Yeah. I was thinking of something about this big.
That's what I thought too.
Lot, yeah. You got a lot of heavy grains in there, not so much yeast.
It could be small, it was dense.
Sounds about right to me.
lot of air in a loaf of bread.
Yeah, uh-huh. Well, the loaf, especially the Wonder Bread I grew up on, which Hoppy ate, of course. But you could take it and squash it, you know.
I used to make little dough balls out of that.
Me too. Wonderful. Yeah. And oh yeah, I loved those. I would play outside. That would be like Popeye's stuff to eat. Because you can carry a lot of it if you squeeze it down.
Yeah.
So, but that's a. I don't even know if one of those is even a pound though. What, even a long one? I think the long one might be a pound.
Yeah.
Yeah. But our loaves that we got at the grocery store, they're a pound.
That gave me some good energy there.
But the next example I can relate to.
Well, Abba Moses was a pretty big fellow too, and he's the one who made that.
That's true.
That recommendation. He was a Moses the Black, right? This is the Abba Moses we're talking about.
Yes.
He was a big fellow.
Probably.
So two of those for him.
Not that much.
Especially with nothing else, might not be as much. I don't know. That's just.
I just don't relate to that example. I don't feel the point of it. But this one I do. Abba Serenius example down at the bottom of the page. This is a report. They went to the cell of Abba Serenius, and they were fed lavishly. This is a monk's version of lavish food in this century. Instead of the brine, salt water, spread over a drop of oil that usually sufficed for daily refreshment, more than that, a bit of fish sauce, self-indulgence, was mixed and poured over more oil than is had in a typical serving. Then he sat out, because he's entertaining, you see now, he's exercising
generous,
the virtue of hospitality. Then he set out a pinch of salt and three olives each, $3 for each one. After this, another course, a basket containing ground chickpeas, from which we took five small pieces, two prunes and one fig per person. For anyone in that desert is considered guilty if he exceeds this much. So this is a feast, the absolute largest conceivable meal for a monk before flat-out gluttony takes over. If you had six chickpeas instead of five, or four olives instead of three. Now that's beyond fasting as we know it.
That must be like about a teaspoonful of chickpeas.
I would be eating a half a pound of chickpeas and as many olives as I could put up with, because they're probably sour. So I don't know how many of those I could eat. A few small fruits, chickpeas, and a little extra sauce is, for St. John, a veritable feast before gluttony takes over. The fast of the layperson would be to the fathers of the conferences, I jumped down, a festival of incomprehensible consumption. It is perhaps best not even to think about what they would have made of our typical diet when not fasting. We bring this up to make a simple point. From the point of view of the Desert Fathers, modern lay Christians basically never really fast at all. When people ask me about what is the rule, and they want to fulfill the rule because they want to do it right, I always send them to Bishop Ware's description of fasting at the beginning of the Lenten Triodion, because he gives there the rule of the monks for fasting during Lent. And it's a wonder they don't drop down dead from starvation, as little as they eat. It's inconceivable almost that they could eat as little as, and this is the rule. So if you want to know the rule and you want to be legalistic, this is it. So recognize the fact that fasting is not about fulfilling a rule. What people generally do to even participate in is what I tell them in the fasting that we all do. When you fast from meat, you fast from dairy, meat includes fish and oil. Now you're getting almost monastic. I mean, you could be legalistic and say, fast from olive oil. They didn't have any other kind of oil. So we use canola oil and vegetable oil and corn oil, and we have a dozen different kinds of oil, but we don't use the olive oil because it says olive oil. Of course, we know they didn't have anything but olive oil. When they fasted from olive oil, they were fasting from oil, period. It's called dry fasting. We don't do that. Very few. I don't know anybody who does it. If you do, don't tell me. Be humble, and maybe it'll give you spiritual benefit. But I don't know anybody who does dry fasting except monks. Today and strict monks at that. So it's not a matter of the rule, it's a matter of what we as lay people do in a parish, in parish life. And the distinction is being made by Opera Wall between real ascetic fasting that is intended to humble the body and humble the will. In order to do that, you have to do fasting at a monastic level. The way we fast can't accomplish that. We fast, he explains to us here and later on in the chapter, we fast as a reminder of fasting and to humble ourselves, thinking of what real fasting is and the fact that we not only don't do it when we're fasting, when we're not fasting, we eat like kings. I mean, kings and emperors would be lucky to eat the way we eat most of the time. Now, we have a problem where half the country is overweight because of the way we eat, and people consider it their right to be able to eat like that. So when they think about becoming Orthodox, they feel like, whoa, it's hard being Orthodox. Orthodox fast in a way that is really difficult. The vegetarians are not usually so impressed. You know, because they don't eat meat anyway. And so it's very difficult for them to get any kind of insight into what fasting is actually all about. Because it's not just about not eating meat and not eating dairy. Opera Wall will make the point that for us, the fasting, the physical fasting from food, is a reminder, first of all, humility with respect to what we know genuine ascetic fasting is, that we aren't even able to practice. It wouldn't be practical for us. We couldn't, he says. You wouldn't be able to fast like that and live a normal life and walk and do the active life that we live in the world, going to work, doing the labor that we do. You couldn't fast the way the monks fast and do that. Anthony the Great would make mats by weaving palm fronds together. He worked. He did that sort of thing. Grew the things that he ate, many of them in his garden. But you know, little bit by little bit, what it takes to actually keep from dying from starvation amounts to a lot less work than what we think. It's an interesting study to realize that that's the case. So monastics can support their bodies at this fasting level without a great deal of labor. The way we work in the modern world, in order to have all the stuff that we do, 40 hours a week of labor or more of a different kind of work in an office or at a computer, we need physical sustenance. We couldn't fast like monks if we wanted to. So, reminder as one of the signposts, reminder, spiritual reminder of what real fasting is like, and also a reminder to the body, because it is at least different than the way we usually eat, a reminder to the body of all of the spiritual fasting from passions and self-indulgence at not so much a physical level, but at an emotional level. We will at least be aware we are fasting. So we're reminded, as the priest generally makes a sermon at the beginning of Lent, to fast from feasting on your brother or your sister. That kind of fasting we can do. And in fact, we have more opportunity than the monks to do it because we live in the world. We have our friends, our acquaintances, people we work with, our family, our brothers and sisters. If it's Thanksgiving, then we have a grand opportunity to fast in that kind of way. So that's the kind of fasting that we can do. Page 176, in the middle, the role of fasting in lay life. The purpose of strict fasting is to cut off bodily urges toward vice by restraining the desires of the stomach. Abba Serapion says, whoever is unable to resist simple pleasures like food will have no chance of grappling successfully with deeper desires. This is the sort of thing that I've found so depressing, as I mentioned to Father Marcus. Restraining one's eating is a relatively simple and easy physical exercise, unless you are in the grip of a passion whose grip on you can't break. But the point that's being made here is that fasting is easy compared to the other spiritual efforts that you will have to make. We are so self-indulgent that fasting seems like a big deal for us as Orthodox parishioners, whereas, as a matter of fact, it's not a big deal. This is the part that's easy. I don't have any trouble not eating meat. I don't have any trouble following the fast, and in the sense that, you know, okay, no meat, no dairy. I don't have any. In fact, I usually feel better during a fast. Now, Sharon doesn't, because her dietetic situation is different. But all that meat, all that dairy makes me sick anyway. You know, I don't have to eat hardly any of it. I'm sick for a day and a half. So I usually feel better during the fast, but all I'm doing is not eating meat and not eating dairy. I still eat too much of the things that I can eat, but it is easy to me to do that. It's strange to me when someone comes to confession and says, and they think they're confessing a sin. They don't realize that this is a spiritual effort that you either make or you don't. You know, and I've told people, when you break the fast, you've broken the fast. I mean, you start again. You continue to make the spiritual effort. But someone will come and they'll say, Father, I slipped. I ate meat. I ate a hamburger. I was just so hungry. And then sometimes they go on to excuse themselves by saying, I have to work, and so I really need meat. Well, this is not true. This is not true. So now you're lying in confession. Don't tell me that. Because I know that you can sustain yourself perfectly well with a little thinking ahead of time and make sure you get enough protein because you need that. But I don't understand why it's difficult for people to stop eating meat for a little while. We have a sense of entitlement. I am entitled to meat. I am entitled to the best. And I am giving this up for Lent. You see, that's not fasting. I'm giving up meat for Lent. I am giving up meat for Lent. Something that I am entitled to do, but I'm giving it up for God. I don't know what that is, but that has nothing to do with actual fasting. You know, and it probably will build pride, for sure. It has nothing to do with ascetic fasting, and it has nothing to do with the kind of role that fasting plays for us as lay people, as compared to monks. Remember, laymen are those who are not monks in this text. I think so it includes me, because I'm not a monk. It has nothing to do with the role that fasting plays in our life either. You know, giving something up for Lent, you know. I mean, it has nothing to do with fasting as we understand it. Okay. Restraining one's eating is a relatively simple and easy physical exercise. This is exactly why it is the best place to begin. It's the best place to begin, not because it's so absolutely hard that if you don't get over this hurdle, forget it. You know, you're not going to be able, which is the way it is for me. It's supposed to be the easy thing to do. If you can't even do this easy thing, you're not even serious about it. Well, I am in the grip of this passion. I confess that. But most people aren't. Most people aren't as fat as I am. I watch Jim Gaffigan. He's a glutton, like me. It's funny, I can identify with him. And he's a stand-up comedian, and he has a situation comedy on TV. Food is his problem. So I even relate to it. Sharon can't relate to it. She thinks it's sad. He's sad and pitiful. But it is sad and pitiful. It is sad and pitiful. That's the thing. Anyway, that's my problem. But for the monks, they're monks. If they can't fast, how are they going to engage in the serious ascetic efforts that go beyond this point? That's the point that's made. That's why it's the best place to begin. Because it's the easy place. Yet the layperson's fast asks so little of the Christian that it is hard to imagine the fathers would find it effective at all as a real exercise in self-denial. In itself, our fast is simply not the same kind of tool as the fast of the desert. Fasting as it is performed by lay people, what is it really for? And then he gives you some historical background. The observance of Lent did not exist so long as the perfection of the primitive church remained intact. This is Abba Theonius, back in his day, from the conferences, talking about the earlier time in the early Christian church. In the early church, the first few hundred years, they were not restricted by any obligations to these principles. No Lenten fasting. Fasting was the norm, since they fasted the whole length of the year. When a large group of believers began declining day by day from this apostolic devotion, it seemed appropriate to the priests that those people who are tangled up in worldly cares and virtually ignorant of abstinence and repentance should be reminded of the holy work of fasting by having it imposed upon them. And so, you know, Lenten fasting began. once the church was legal, I'll bet. Abba Theonis compares those worldly Christians for whom Lent was created to Ananias and Sapphira, who were struck dead by the Holy Spirit about lying for their refusal to hand over all their goods to the church. But they held back out some of their wealth, and when it's, we've given everything up. You know, it's like when we walk in and say, okay, it's Lent, I'm giving everything up, I'm fasting, this is my ascetic effort. It's not. We're still eating all the things that we're eating that a serious ascetic monk would not eat. We're making concessions to the fact that we live in the world, and yet we want to feel like, oh, Father, I've heard this, you know, already. Oh, Father, being Orthodox is really difficult because we're really strict, you know, compared to people who, you know, Protestants, they don't have Lent. You know, we fast no meat for 40, nay, 50 days. My wife always reminds me it's not 40 days, it's 40 days, huh?
48, I think.
48 days, 40 days plus Holy Week. No meat, no anything that you want. You sit and you say, finally, halfway through Lent, there is nothing that I can eat that I have any interest in. Good, you know, you're in Lent then. And that's when the bulgur, whatever that stuff is, the gold.
Kasha.
Kasha starts to sound good. You know why? Because we cheat. Because we put oil in it. It's only one of the only things we can get that has oil in it, which you're not even supposed to have. If you took the oil out, you wouldn't want to look at it. So we do things like that.
Couldn't get it down.
You couldn't get it down, for sure. So, and that's the way we are. So we are lying about our refusal to hand over our passions. That's the comparison. For Abba Theonis, Christians in the world after the age of the apostles began to deny God their abstinence in a similar way to the way Ananias and Sapphira held back part of their wealth, because that's what they really depended on. People like them began to take the church from a place where things like fasting happened all the time to a place where they never happened at all. In light of this problem, according to Abba Theonis, the church's fasting calendar was originally created as a means for calling people in the world back to the pursuit of basic virtue, similar to the role that repentance and the Eucharist play in our lives in the world, calling us back, you know, reminding us of where the center of spiritual life is, which is to say, back to the pursuit of purity of heart. And we have all of those ways which we pursue purity of heart in the world. That's okay. So the previous 176 pages is all about that. The different way that we pursue purity of heart in the world as compared to the way it's done in the monastery. So now we have yet another contrast. What fasting means in the monastery, what fasting means to us. We should not start to think the real way is the way the monks do it. We are second-class citizens. That's not true. The context is different. We can be, as the angel said to Saint Anthony, your equal lives in Constantinople. That's all he needed to know. He didn't need to know that quite possibly the equal that lives in Constantinople, his spiritual equal, may have lived as we live. Something more like we live, not as self-indulgent as we are. But he did not necessarily live as a monk in Constantinople. That's the point of this book. You could live in Constantinople and be equally intense in your pursuit of spiritual heart, but in a different context, by way of your interactions with others in society, rather than the way the monks do it. So there's the way the monks do it, and there's the way we do it. And we're still following that contrast of the one as compared to the other. Okay, so this is given to us in the world to call us back to the pursuit of basic virtue, not by extreme ascetic fasting, or even ascetic fasting at all, really, but by the ways that we can pursue purity of heart in the world. While the earliest church, according to Abba Theonis, did not need such legalistic restraints to remind us of the essential Christian goal, purity of heart, we should be thinking purity of heart as soon as we start to think about fasting. While the earliest church did not need such legalistic restraints to remind of the essential Christian goal, purity of heart, the laity of the later church does. The requirements of Lent, he says, do not actually emulate or copy or follow ascetic effort of the early church or the desert. The really righteous person, he teaches, will fast well beyond the demands of Lent. As such, the fast of the church calendar is a kind of acting out of the desert abstinence, not genuinely very ascetic in itself, but a nod to the real thing, acknowledging, yes, there is something like fasting, I remember now, but our serious spiritual effort in the world will always have to do with others. Thus, the fasting of lay people in accordance with the teachings of Abba Theonis really has only a little to do with restraining the will through the force of abstinence. Instead, fasting in accordance with the church calendar infuses into Christian life a rhythm that calls the mind back to the pursuit of purity of heart. That's what fasting is for us in the world. It makes our struggle against sin material, because we are physically fasting, at least in this kind of way that we do, but not in the sense of serious bodily denial. Rather, it infuses materiality into our pursuit of purity of heart by affecting, according to a cycle, the four fasting seasons of the year and Wednesday and Friday, the things that we eat, rather than introducing real hunger. It thus does much more to remind us of the material nature of our battle with sin than it does to really impact that battle on the physical plane. Facing that bowl of lentil soup that would have been a feast to Abba Moses, the mind ought to be drawn to remember that we must make real and actual the work of seeking purity of heart through our lives in society, our families, our work, and the rest. We deny ourselves almost nothing of food, but in denying just a little on fixed date throughout the year, signposts, you see, we remember that we must really go out and struggle to cultivate the virtue to which we know that we are called. It is important that this not be misunderstood as a potential excuse to take Orthodox fasting lightly, or merely pay lip service to fasting days that we are meant to actually observe. Abba Theonis' teaching implies just the opposite. For him, the fast of Lent and the other fasts are an absolute minimum in the spiritual life of a Christian. Otherwise, we'll have no reminders and we will completely give ourselves over to the world without this physical reminder. As a minimum, people who always want to know the rules, as a minimum, therefore, the fasting calendar must be observed as maximally as possible within the Christian life. So fast from meat, fast from dairy, fast in that kind of way. But recognize how, by comparison to real ascetic fasting, this is not an ascetic effort. It's just a reminder that such a thing exists. To fail to observe even this would be to virtually walk away from the pursuit of purity of heart altogether. The final excuse, you know, this, run into it again and again. Meet somebody who hasn't been to church in 20 years and they'll tell me about how they had a run-in with somebody 20 years ago and from now on they're never going to church. You know, it's the final excuse, you know. Like I said, from now on, because of that, I'm never coming back. People will look for such excuses. I find them all the time, you know, and it's not just about coming to church, but here as far as fasting. So we need to not misunderstand this and take it as a final excuse to just ignore fasting. When understood this way, fasting as a layperson ought to strike us as a fairly easy burden. This, in turn, ought to help guide us to a great deal of humility. Now, that makes, I think, perfectly good sense. I'm just going to stop there. Because, you know, my object was to, you know, we'll get beyond the fasting part, and we can maybe start the prayer part, at least this week, and maybe we can finish in another week. Or maybe 2 weeks. So, what is the point? Or do we take the point? You know, and does this make a difference as far as, you know? I mean, it's easy to fall into the feeling that boy, here comes Great Lent. Oh, what a burden! It's so awful. I'm thinking about food all the time. We should at least realize how screwed up we are to even get into that state of mind. I mean, we're so far from making an ascetic effort. It's ridiculous. It's like me admitting that I'm in the grip of the sin of gluttony. We should at least recognize that we are in the grip of the sin of, now I don't know that it's gluttony, but it's a kind of self-indulgence of just feeling as though we are entitled to the best all the time, meat 24/7, 365 days a year, if we want it. Anything else is God is denying me, my poor body, the stuff that I've gotten used to, that my body takes as the norm, for me not to have it is just too much, it's too harsh. And by comparison with actual ascetic effort, we reach the point that we realize this is a very light burden whose primary intent is to remind us that we ought to be engaged in our life in the pursuit of purity of heart. What do people think?
It seems to me, Father, one of the things that Daniel and is pointing out is that fasting, and you've said before, is not an end in itself. I wonder how many other practices are like that in the church that, you know, we kind of think, well, I'm doing something spiritual just because.
What do you have in
fasting?
Mind?
I don't know. Nothing. Well,
they would have to be physical practices.
Right. Just standing through church services. Like this is
no,
my service
we stand through
God.
Church services because we're standing in the presence of God.
I just, you know, I think that those we're standing there as a.
So now, it's not an ascetic effort, really. You know, it's not, you know.
It's just the appropriate thing.
It's the appropriate thing to do. And another thing is, too, you sit at a performance that you are passively watching and not participating in. And even if you can't stand, the body is standing in a spiritual way because you're only sitting because your knee is blown out and you can't stand. But you still, even though you're sitting, spiritually speaking, you are in the same kind of spiritual relationship to God, standing in the presence of God. Even if you're physically unable to stand, you know, even if you're in a wheelchair, the physical humility ought to be there. That's why we stand. We don't stand as an ascetic discipline. And anyway, I mean, once you get used to it, it's just not that big a deal.
No.
You know, one of the boys asked me the other day, you know, how can you stand like that? I've been standing like that for over 40 years, nothing, really, and I'm almost 70.
I just wonder how many of those things that I have the feeling like, well, I've done something spiritual, but the reality is I have begun to try to participate in something that if I would really participate in it, maybe I could, you know, gain repentance and actual changes. But we've done this with food itself. It's like food and fasting. Food we've made instead of eating for sustenance, we've made the eating an end in itself.
Sure.
Rather than eating, and now we want to do the opposite.
Well, eating does have the capacity to build our ego and our sense of.
So does fasting. If we do it the wrong way, that's
well,
why we can do the same
true,
thing.
That's true, but it's
mm-hmm. Make it an end in itself. There's a lot. I was thinking a lot of things that we do that started off as something we just need to do to travel somewhere, you know, and then we made a better way or faster way to do it. And it's become an end in itself. What kind of car are you driving? You make it look a certain way.
Yeah.
And dressing.
I heard an advertisement about cars the other day and said, what is the real most important thing about a car? It's how it makes you feel. That's the advertisement.
That's the Lincoln, I think.
Yeah,
but it's not. It's getting from point A to point B.
Yeah.
But
it doesn't break down.
Right. But there's so many things in our lives that. Or we seem to have a tendency to allow ourselves to make it an end. Like something we start doing because we need to do it becomes an end in itself. And I just wonder what that tendency is about. It's, you know, and the fact that food, that the eating and fasting can each fall into that category in our minds, that they themselves are an end in themselves is interesting. I don't know if it leads anywhere.
Yeah, I think our rejection or our rebelliousness toward Great Lent, being as how we fast only in the way that we do, is more about our egotistical sense that we are giving up something that we are entitled to. You know, it's more about will than it is about denying the body. Because the body is not being particularly denied. You know, it's you know, which is part of the point I think he's making. So if that's not the case, why do we rebel against it so much? Because it's like, I have the right to have this. Are you taking this away from me? You are giving me a rule that says I can't eat meat. And so our rebelliousness comes, we go past you know, whatever is a decent hamburger these days. I don't know. I don't buy Public hamburgers, you know. But you know, and just, but I remember a time when I had, I wanted a. Well, we used to have Whataburgers down south. You know, I mean, really, you know. Well, I know I'm in Georgia, but still, they don't have them in Georgia. They don't have Whataburgers. So they're in Louisiana. They have Whataburgers. It's Whataburger.
Whataburger.
Whataburgers. And being as how I'm from Pennsylvania, I just say Whataburger, and nobody even knows what I'm talking about because people from Pennsylvania don't say water right.
Yes.
So it's not Whataburger. It's not water. When I say Whataburger, it sounds like Whataburger, but that's why. It's because I'm from Pennsylvania. But it's a Whataburger.
Whataburger.
Yeah. Those are the ones I would want because they are the biggest, the fattest, the, you know, the super, I mean, you know, what do you call them? Burger King's.
Five Guys. That's what you want. Five Guys.
It doesn't even, the Whopper doesn't even come close to a Whataburger.
Yeah.
And you get a double Whataburger with cheese. And if you're not under 30, you've got a heart attack on your plate. You know, those are the ones I used to want. So I haven't eaten those in many, many years. But but don't I have a right to have? You mean I cannot have a Whataburger for 50 days? Are you kidding? You know, that's not about the needs of the body. That's something else.
The Georgia equivalent of that, I think, is Five Guys.
Five Guys burgers and fries.
Five Guys. I've been there maybe twice. They bring you an impossibly big burger, and then if you order a small fries,
uh-huh.
A small fries is bigger than an extra large fries, and you know, it's this big. If you order a large fries, it comes in a paper bag. It's a sack. It literally comes in a greasy paper bag that many. It's ridiculous.
Peanuts
while you wait, just, you know, to keep you starving.
This is what Five Guys should eat.
Right? It's enough for Five Guys, it really is. I don't know why I guess Five Guys started it. I don't know, maybe Mike knows.
Okay.
I guess so, I don't know. I'll find it. You go through and you're not eating meat, but then you come up with nice recipes for some rich food and you eat a lot of that. And
feel sure.
It's as bad as going to Quincy.
No. There's
coconut milk.
She knew what I was thinking about.
It's cheating.
That is really cheating. Of course it tastes good. Too. You know how much oil is in coconut? Coconut. I mean, they can get oil out of a coconut.
It's saturated oil. That's what it is. It's like meat.
You can make it taste fat. Like you shouldn't be
so
eating it.
So when you eat it, you're like, oh, this is so good. It's like meat. Yeah.
Well, that's you're not fasting anymore, folks.
I remember when we first, you know, we were inexperienced at it here. We would have beans and rice, and we didn't really know what else to eat.
You didn't know how to cheat yet.
We went for a whole year up to St. John's, and when we were going up there, I said, this is like, I can't tell I'm fasting.
Yeah.
this is wonderful. These people have it perfected. This, the food, these old Orthodox people that have been doing it for a long time with it. I said, I don't know, how can we call this fasting? This is wonderful. Now, of course, I did not eat it. Keep that. I ate it and enjoyed it. But
it would,
and tried to learn the recipes. But,
yes, it would be prideful not to.
Oh, that's right.
So, you got that covered. I remember sitting next to Archbishop Dimitri trying to convince him that Volker burgers weren't okay. This fasting tastes like a hamburger. You know, it can't be. This can't be right. Archbishop Dimitri, see, look at the ingredients. It's okay. You know, it tastes like a hamburger.
Oh, he said that?
Yeah. Didn't think it was right. I mean, to make it taste like... Yeah, we do that. So technically we fast. Technically we keep this little rule that we have that isn't even ascetic.
He was a monastic. It had been a while since he'd had an actual hamburger. I don't think Boga Burgers taste that much like a hamburger.
I don't even know if he... Yeah, he ate meat. I know he did. He made great chili.
Okay.
Oh, his chili was... It was real Texas chili. It was wonderful. He would come and he would make chili for us.
Oh.
Yeah. He's going by. Okay, I'm not going to start on a new section. It's close to the... To the end, we got through it. I hope some significant points were made. You know that I didn't just kind of take up your time trying to emphasize these points. Everybody's read it. You probably got and out of it, as, you know, all of that on your own, don't you think? You did, huh?
I didn't read that part. I read, not this time. I read the part on balance.
Prayer and contemplation. So next time we'll do prayer, page 179. Beholding the kingdom, prayer and contemplation. This actually is a completely new section in the chapter because we've had the examples of signposts is what we've been looking at. Started on page 165, remembering purity. So that's what fasting is for us, to remember the pursuit of purity of heart. Eucharist, repentance, and fasting. So this is a new section in the chapter that we'll start next week. Beholding the kingdom, prayer and contemplation. He's going to say there are four different types of prayer. And then beyond that, there is contemplation. So there's actually five, but the fifth one he treats separately at the end of this section.
I think his last sentence in the paragraph at the top of 179 is almost poetic.
Last? Go ahead, read it.
Drawing us ever away from such pride and toward a memory of our goal, the rhythm of the fast should become a drumbeat call in our lives, inviting us to the material pursuit of purity of heart and reminding us of what we are here for, like a companion whispering over and over throughout the year that we are called to God's kingdom.
Yeah, that really captures the whole thing. I mean, in there is the fact that it is a signpost, but it is a reminder of pursuit of purity of heart. And it's like when I made the really dumb example using how I never get to finish a pipe, but it's an ongoing thing that I always want to do, and you remember the doing of it, that spiritual life is, because it's signposts during the year, each one brings you back to what is the continuity of your life, the continuity of the meaning of your life. These signposts bring you back to that. Where am I going on the highway? I'm going to the place that is my destiny, ultimately the kingdom of God, by way of this highway that is the pursuit of purity of heart, and there are signposts and guide rails that keep me on that road, and this is one of them. Fasting is one of those signposts. That's the role that fasting plays in our life, and we need to get over this idea that we're making this huge ascetical effort, because we're not.
We're just trying to make an attempt to take the road to take us where we're trying to go.
Right.
So what is the use of a reminder for us?
Well, you have to have what you're being reminded of, and what you're, otherwise the reminder won't do you any good. So you have, if you're not making an effort to pursue purity of heart in all of your relationships, friendships where people, what they have in common is they are both involved in the pursuit of purity of heart. If you've never done that, and you don't have that kind of a relationship with anybody in your family, which is families, that's what they should be, that's what should be taking place there, in your parish, with your priest at confession, then you won't have anything to be reminded of. You've got to have that primary experience of the pursuit of purity of heart. It's what the monks are doing, but we're supposed to be doing it too. Except that we do it by way of our relationships with those around us, so that each Christian friendship should be, and if it's not it's not a Christian friendship. Each Christian friendship is a friendship where what you have in common is that you are both pursuing purity of heart. You gotta have that. That's what you're being reminded of. That's what you're being called back to. When you fast, you remember, oh yes, the way I'm living is not to pursue purity of heart. So all of those signposts remind you of that. So does confession should remind you of that. And remember I said last week, if we find some other way of using confession other than that, like if we come up with some kind of legalistic idea that we're going and we're confessing our sins and we're getting forgiven, and then, you know, that's the way we do confession, then it's not serving the purpose of being a signpost to remind us that what we're supposed to be involved with is the pursuit of purity of heart. Because that's the only reason we're going. to pursue purity of heart and to be reminded, you know, and have the example of, here I have done this, this is a departure from the pursuit of purity of heart. You know, and we're forgiven because we get back on the highway and we keep going on that road. Confession is that kind of a signpost. So, that's how it works. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.